Welcome to Searching for Marna, the podcast focused on tech innovation in finance, fintech. I'm Lloyd Warhead and I'm a headhunter. I'm privileged to spend my days meeting with some of the influencers, leaders and founders in technology and finance, from unicorn companies to financial disruptors. This podcast, we're going to be hearing from these individuals and really try to understand how they got into fintech, what they're doing, what their company is all about, and perhaps some of the trends that they're looking at in the market. Welcome on to Searching for Marna, Ray.
Hi, cool. Good to be here. Thank you.
Fuller introduction. So Ray Brash, CEO and chairman at PPS.
Mm-hmm. Don't know how that happened.
Good fortune. Bit of luck.
A lot of luck.
So just in brief, so the audience can understand what you're up to today, could you talk us through PPS, please?
Yeah, of course I can. And sorry if I'm a bit croaky. We were at the Card and Payment Awards last night and actually won an award. So I'll get that one in quickly.
And congratulations.
Well, thanks. Yeah, that's terrific.
What was the award?
It was, let me get this right. Yeah, best achievement in payment processing.
Wow.
And a couple of my clients also got commendations. So guys like Tide Banking, Counting Up, Moniz got a nomination. And I guess that explains a bit about what we do. You know, essentially we're a payment processor, but really we're working with other clients like fintechs, you know, Moniz and Tide. So we're providing all the back end. So when you switch on your app and you do your payments through the app, that's effectively our customers who are, you know, onboarding customers and have that experience. Everything underneath has been driven by us. So whether that's the banking payments, whether it's the card payments, whether it's the regulation, all of those things. So we kind of provide all that through banking as a service. But really it's the brands that you'll know. You wouldn't necessarily know PPS.
Yeah.
You know our customers' brands. And that's really essentially what we do.
You're like the watchmaker behind the watchmaker.
Yeah, the watchmaker, watchman, or something like that. Yeah, definitely. I've never really seen the watchmaking analogy, but yeah, exactly. I mean, we do quite a bit of PR and marketing in our industry, but it's not really our focus to get the PPS brand everywhere because it distracts. We're an outsourced part of these companies. So if you take a company like Tide, they're doing an amazing job. In terms of their positioning, their community, what they're doing for small businesses, and building a lot of really nice add-ons. But actually, the fundamental part of what they do is done by us. So it's really important that we are seamless for them, because they're outsourcing a large part of their operation, you know? And so they put a lot of trust in us. So we really try and focus on that, and we don't really try and shout too much about us as a company. We really let our, if we're doing our job well, then our clients are going to do well, and that's really our business model.
So if we dig into this space, and then we'll also go through the 15-year journey that you've had with PPS, I believe.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Who else is doing this in the space? So the merchants and the vendors, and then companies that you would consider at your type of size, are there names that we might know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the UK is pretty strong in the payment side, obviously. We're doing issuing processing. So,
yeah.
You know, you've got a Stripe who's doing acquiring, you know, they're an acquirer.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're on the merchant side.
Yeah.
We're on the issuing side. So we're working with, historically, you might have said we'd work with banks, but we work with relatively few banks. We work with RBS, but we are, and we're quite unusual because payments is complicated. Yeah, that's kind of goes without saying. And there are lots of different parts of the supply chain. And typically, you might have three or four companies joined up with a customer to deliver something. We do all of that. So there's no single company, I would say, who is a like-for-like competitor. But if you're talking about pure processing, so the technical piece, then you've got guys like FIS or GPS, Marqeta, Galileo, these type of players, okay? Then you've got more of the traditional kind of First Data's and T-Sys's and those sort of guys. who tend to work more with the big banks. But that's just on processing. But we are also an issuer, so we're a regulated company, so we have our own license with MasterCard.
Okay.
Now, in that context, we might be competing with a Wirecard, for example.
So if you have a client like Moniz, they could come to you, as you say, for everything that is working infrastructure-wise through that payment process from beginning to end. And so we could attribute that to why you're doing quite well, so well in fintech.
Well, I think so, because we can get startups up and running very quickly. And I mean, Tide, I think that's a really interesting one because, I mean, Tide are huge now.
Yeah. And you work with them from the beginning?
We work with them. When I say them, we work with him from the beginning. So I remember I got a call 5 years ago, probably, and we were just starting to develop what is now our, effectively, our banking product. And when I say banking, we've been doing prepaid cards for 15 years, which were just cards. So they kind of worked, and a lot of people would use it, but by the, I mean, if you wanted to make a payment to your utility company or direct debit or get your salary, you couldn't really use these cards.
Because, so what can you use them for?
Well, you could basically go to a PayPoint, put some cash on the card, and then you know, buy stuff on the internet, because at the time you couldn't buy things on the internet with cash. Or you might be someone who couldn't get a bank account, but you just needed somewhere to keep some money.
Yep.
So you keep them on the prepaid card. You might use it for travel or things like that. So it was a limited market. But we realized, and it was something I was really sort of could see coming, but wasn't exactly sure how it worked, that if you could plug, you know, the normal banking that we all know and expect into this sort of prepaid concept, which was, you know, standalone, then it would supercharge it. And that's exactly what's happened to the industry and to us as well. But so anyway, going back to home, so I got a call from a chap called Errol Damlin, who was the original founder of Wonga. He's a well-known angel investor. He's invested in some of the early fintechs. And he had, so I've got this guy who's really looking, ex-Barclaycard guy, who's looking to do a banking thing. And I said, well, that's great, because we're...
How had he met him?
I think he'd he was an angel investor.
So he'd been pitched.
He'd been pitched, and whether background or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I said, "That's really great," you know. And I think I was skiing at the time, and I thought, and I said, and he said, "You know, is your banking product ready?" "Yeah, of course it is. It's definitely ready. It's, I'm ready to go," you know, as you do. And so the next thing, I had a call with the original founder, George Beavis, who is the original founder of Tide. And he took me through what I wanted to do, and it was very ambitious, you know, incredibly ambitious. And I thought, I'm not sure about this, because, you know, in our business, you get a lot of people who come with ideas, and 95% just never go anywhere. And I thought, well, actually, we need to launch a client. You know, we have this banking product. What better way of launching it than with a customer? So the first meeting, George, bless him, turned up with his bicycle clips and his helmet and his Brompton under his arm in the office in Paddington. And
the lean startup,
you know, and I sort of said, great, so are we being joined by anyone else? He said, it's only me. really? Okay. So then for the next year, we worked literally with him on this idea. And this shows you what we were capable of doing, because he didn't need anything other than his idea to work with us, because we could deliver everything. And we were able to hit a milestone to get a product, a very basic MVP out there that enabled him to get, you know, start getting his Series A.
Yeah.
And blah, blah, blah.
Can you remember what, I'm sure you can, what that MVP allowed you to do?
I think he literally had, there was like 50 cards, and he would hand them out to like his angels and say, look, if you can use this card, I will send you money through a bank account onto this card, and it'll work. And that was it, you know. And I think it didn't really have an app or anything. But that went on, and of course now Tide are, I mean, the fundraising, you've seen they've raised, you know, I don't know, 80, 90 million, most public recent. They won 65 million from the RBS DRG fund to promote SME. You'll see them all over London taxis or whatever. But it was interesting because in our business, which is very big, you know, we've tried to make sure that we have that incubator part, that mentality, that whilst we have some very, very large clients globally, I still try and keep a little reserve part of the business for the guys who come in like that.
Yeah, because I was going to ask two things. One is what Tide looks like today, what his idea looked like.
I think so, yeah. The only thing I remember saying, because I think he'd had Shoreditch fever, so he was sort of saying, we need £1 million limits because all these, the first round, all my clients are going to get all this fundraising. And, you know, because in payments and in the day, no one had £1 million limit on a card, okay? Prepaid has always been,
very low.
A couple of thousand, yeah. 3,000, whatever. And that was the first thing he said was, I need £1 million limit. And my risk guys were like freaking out. What are you talking about? £1 million, that's crazy. But he very much had a kind of, his problem as trying to set up a business, he was reflecting that, which is fine, because most of the entrepreneurs have the same thing.
Yeah.
Where it is now is, SME, gig guys, someone's opened up a tattoo parlor, can't get a bank account.
Yeah.
So 5 to 50 max.
Yeah.
So it's the economy. It's not the Shoreditch kind of.
I walked into, this is a recurring theme that the audience will hear, the Old Street roundabout, and they'd taken out a pop-up store within that. And you could go into that and there was a number of iPads that you could immediately sign up to get a side account.
Brilliant.
And I started the process because one of the sales ladies suckered me in, and then I didn't complete it because of the limits at that point that they had. So it didn't make sense for my particular business.
Yeah.
But that was the first time that I saw Tide, and I was like, that's quite aggressive guerrilla marketing. I like this.
Yeah.
And then we worked with them since. And obviously they've just gone on to really exciting success. And the campaign they've got out now, what I like about it is it's really just showing the success stories that their lending has afforded.
Yeah.
It's really nice. You've got, people like you say, you have a hairdressing salon and they're the advert. So that's pretty cool. The second part of the question was, so that worked for you then because you wanted to get started with that product in banking.
Yeah.
And I know that you say you still afford to have a small incubation view of who you're going to business with. But I was wondering if actually that really is where the market is for you. You're surely looking to partner up with the companies that are more mature, have a fuller service, and therefore there's a higher volume of payments going through their business. Why would you? I suppose the question is, why would you be entrepreneurial and try and back someone like you did originally with a Tide founder? That was timely then, which was fortunate for him, and got your product starting. Would you still do that now, and why?
We would and we do, but we're very selective about it. And it sounds a bit arrogant, I suppose, to say, well, we select our partners, but we don't have 500 customers. That's not our business. Our business is to have maybe 100 that we have a road, a journey with, and that's either expansion or more products. As they grow, we help them grow. But we still do that, and for two reasons, really. The first one is, they've learned a lot from looking at the big guys. They realize you're not just going to come in and, I have customers saying, what are you going to do? Are we going to be the next Revolut? Okay, thanks a lot. Nice. Good luck, But we've got guys who are coming in who see that they can take X and Y and make something different and address certain markets which aren't still being addressed. I mean, financial services is desperately unaddressed. It's not just banking, but insurance, wealth management, pensions, all these sort of areas. So, firstly, we still want to engage because they could be the next Revolut of wealth management or pensions.
Right.
The second thing is it's really fun. And I really believe that the culture rubs off, I'm 54. I wouldn't say I'm kind of a Shoreditch, hipster or anything, but actually I love working with these people. And your behavior, what you learn, what you see in terms of success and failure, but really for our staff as well. You know, we've got guys who I can say, okay, you need to go to Amsterdam tomorrow. We've got this really interesting, you know, fintech. They want to do stuff. So for a 30-something guy at PBS, they think, wow, that's great. I'm getting this exposure. Yeah. As long as they don't go work for them, which has happened. But they learn. They're in the kind of vibe as well. And we learn. And as a payment company in today versus, I would say, some of the more monolithic major players, this constant exposure to ideas enables us to think about what products, how do we need to change our company in the future. So it's almost like free, you know, education. Yeah. And it's fun.
What's interesting there is if you're a startup founder, or if you're early on in your journey, then a lot of the advice is, you know, go and pitch venture capitalists the whole time. Go and get mentors who have probably worked in a similar type of industry and gone through a similar growth story. But actually here, what's worked for founder Tide was that he went and got the relationship with you. Mm-hmm. And of course the idea, and then absolutely of course the transacting on that idea for him was incredibly challenging, and he's clearly done very well to date. But actually that relationship and that meeting and working with you guys now is a huge part of the reason that he's had such great success.
We'd like to think so.
Yeah.
But it was his and he's still, you know, he's still around, George. They've got a new MD obviously, but which happens normal in startups. Yeah. But it was his idea. It's their execution of their campaigning, of the way the app works, the integration, all of that. You know, without that, we wouldn't be doing it. You know, wouldn't be successful. So it's the complement of the two. And you're right. Payments is, as I said earlier on, it's very complicated, and there's a lot of smoke and mirrors. You know, there's a lot of, we're doing this. But actually you're not, because you're working with someone else who's working with someone else. So you're positioning yourself. And when you really dig under the skin, you know, is your API as good as you say it is, for example? And so delivering credible products that work is a big part of the pitch. You know,
yeah, in that's payments. Right.
Because, you know, anyone can come up with an app to, deliver, booze at 9 o'clock at night, you know, within an hour, for example. An investment I've just put in actually, by the way. But, not from personal need, or I should say, but I know it's a good idea. But anyone can do that. But creating a payment product with that user experience is not straightforward. Yeah. So if you can show that it works, like George did way back, then you are halfway there.
For the booze investment,
that
will be about logistics. That will be the trick there.
Yeah. It's apparently delivered cold. So you get your...
Wow.
If you need a cold beer in an hour... and you can't be bothered to go out, this is the company to invest in.
What are they called?
They're called Drinkify or something. I can't remember actually. It was just a Cedars thing. Look them up on Cedars.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So we're 15 years into the PPS story.
Yeah.
We understand the last 5 years or there or thereabouts. Mm. If we go back to trying to understand how it was set up, mm-hmm. and the philosophy that has led you to today, I'd quite like to go pre that, if possible. Mm-hmm. So you were not at university, is that correct? You didn't get a degree, or you did?
No, I did. Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I didn't get. Yeah, I mean, if we go back, I came. My parents, Scots, so I actually still consider myself Scots. And it's funny because I was born in England and I have something to stick about that. But my mum always used to say to me, don't be bad. Don't be bad about the English. They've been very good to us. You know, that sort of thing. And, but they came from a kind of working class background, or upper working class, if you call that. My mum set up a couple of shops. And so from an early age, I was kind of, I started to get into sort of retail and thinking about small businesses, and you know, and I used to serve in the shop. And I was
so she managed her own shops.
Yeah, yeah.
What
yeah.
type of shops were they?
Home brew equipment. You know,
in the days in
the days in the 70s where people used to brew their own awful concoctions and keep them under the cupboard in the stirred. You know,
That's great.
But in those days, it was fun and people loved it. And and I sort of kind of got quite interested. There is a bit of a theme, although I wouldn't have drunk most of the stuff that we made. But when I and I actually went, probably went to a private school, the first generation of my who went to that. But my parents didn't know what a private school was, so it just happened to be one that was near, and they said, "Well, that'll do."
Yep.
It turned out it was a Christian Science school, and I'm not a Christian scientist. Yeah, Christian Science is, you know, not quite at the sort of you know Scientology level.
Yeah,
but it's sort of in between.
I have a friend who went to the same type of school.
Yeah,
and he turned out okay.
Yeah,
it didn't affect you negatively.
No, it didn't, and it was a very pastoral upbringing. And people say, "Was it about cults?" And I said, "No, not really. Although you're not allowed, if you're a Christian Scientist, you can't take medicine."
Yeah.
And my best friend, his dad was a faith healer.
Okay.
So it's not a cult. Yeah, apart from the fact that my best friend's dad was a faith healer. Yeah, okay, apart from that.
They had you convinced.
Yeah. So, but the point I was making was, for me, I left with pretty rubbish A-levels, actually. But I thought, oh, they're okay. Because my parents hadn't, you know, they weren't driving me. They had no expectation about that. So
Did you gravitate towards at school? Had you... you know, had any type of success in sport, music, or were you more numerical, or it was just an experience of turning up?
And music. I was really into music from an early age. Okay. I had a school band and stuff like that.
And what instrument did you play?
Bass guitar. I had a keyboard as well, but I played bass guitar. That was the easiest one to start with. You know? So you just sort of you do that. And I think we were called Nothing at the Moment, which I thought was quite a good idea, because everyone said, "What's the name of your band?" It's all Nothing at the Moment. So music was really important to me, sport as usual. But I think I was interested in things like economics, so I did an economics area, didn't do very well. But I wanted to do business studies, because I, you know, having been in the background.
Yep.
And at the time, the polytechnics were doing, the only ones doing business studies degrees, you know? And again, so I actually got an offer to go to Greenwich, what it's called Greenwich University, so Thames Poly as it was then. And I thought, this is great, you know, because I had no expectation about red brick or anything. And I thought, I've got what I wanted, whatever. And my parents thought, this is pretty good, you know, that sort of thing. Absolutely loved the time I was there, 4 years with a year placement at a computer company at the time.
Cool.
And I happened to get a first.
Wow.
Which I guess a first in a poly is kind of a 2-2 at a red brick. But That was business studies with finance. And I don't want to be disrespectful to it, because I think actually there's some amazing, you know, old polys now, you know, if we've got Oxford Brookes and University of West of England. Ollie Purdy from Lute was University of West of England.
Yeah. Yeah, high up the rankings.
Yeah, well, they're great. But they were very vocational, and that was for me.
Yeah.
And I managed to get an interview with PwC, or Price Waterhouse as it was then, and somehow blagged the interview, because I guess I've been pretty good at talking about it. So I got into Price Waterhouse, and then became a qualified chartered accountant. It was just interesting 2 or 3 years, because I was kind of rubbing shoulders with all the sort of red bricks and everything else. So I probably, in terms of challenges, early challenges career-wise, that feeling that you probably don't quite fit, you know, if that makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So whether that was led a little bit, was a bit chippy or something, I don't know. Anyway, left there. This is going on too long. Tell me if it's too long, by the way. And I wanted to get into business. I sort of really, not entrepreneurial at the stage. I wasn't brave enough for that. The band I was in at the time wanted me to go on tour. You can say, because the drummer wanted to say, this is my career.
Had you named the band by
that
point?
Band, there was about the fifth band I'd ever been in, I think. I can't remember what we were called. I've so many names, I can't remember. But he wanted to do it as a career. So I want to, you know, we want to make this a go. And the thing about music is, certainly now, well, in those days, you have to be so hungry to do it. And I wasn't hungry enough, I think, and I probably felt I needed to.
You'd got the taste of accounting.
Oh, wow. Rock and roll. Yeah. And so in the end, I left. So I left PwC and I joined at the time Woolworths, which was part of Kingfisher. And the only reason I got that job was I subsequently found out about 10 years later because my first boss is one of my best friends, and I still see him a lot. And this may have come across appropriately, but he said to me after about 5 or 6 years, you know how you actually got that job? I said, well, I was the best candidate. He said, no, you weren't the best candidate. There was a girl who I interviewed as well, he said, and Mike was, you know, pretty straight, very sort of politically correct and very sort of, you know, conservative. And at the end of the interview, the girl leant over and put her hand on his knee and said, I really want this job, you know.
Wow.
And Mike was so scared. He didn't. He said, I can't give her the job.
Oh my God.
So I only got the job because of that. So, but anyway, as a finance guy, I was never a kind of...
You didn't lean over and put your hand on his knee.
Not then. Maybe later. For me, it was like the numbers were how businesses worked, you know. I wasn't even very good at maths. I'm not brilliant at maths. But for me, it felt like to understand a business, if you understood the numbers, then you understood the business. It's like the blood that flows around a business. And once you understand the business, then you can sort of put everything else around it, whether it's the positioning, the people, yep, the technology. And working in Woolworths in those days was such fun because I wasn't in a classic finance environment. I was actually in the trading business with buyers and marketing people, and I was literally part of that team. And we'd be saying it was confectionery and video games and those sort of things. And it was sort of, okay, why are chocolate sales down last week? And you look out the window, it'd be 29 degrees. It's like, yeah, it was, you know, all, at the time, the supermarkets were just starting to get into stuff like videos. And this is, you're probably too young to remember, but you know, you'd have the big blockbuster video would be like Lion King, and that was the bulk of the business that we were doing. But you'd have Tesco's, who would only sell the Lion King, and they'd sell it for £2 loss to get people in. So I'd have to do a lot of analysis at midnight. Well, how much can we drop the price? It was the start of
matching the Lion King.
Oh, there we go. Siri, be quiet, please. The video game boom was just starting, the old Sega Mega Drives, and Woolworths in those days was a massive retailer, you know.
Because I'm old enough to remember it. Yeah, well, I used to go to the one in Wimbledon where I grew up and get my Pick-a-Mix and pretty much everything else that you're interested in if you were a kid. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was as a kid, it was just amazing. An Aladdin's cave. When I was like 12, 13, getting the bus into town and going and getting like the latest Pretenders vinyl album from Woolies was, that made your whole day.
Yeah.
And it's incredible to think about that now.
So it was amazing to then end up working at this brand that you had these fond memories as a child of, and making decisions that are not so quantitative, but I suppose instinct-based.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes they worked, and sometimes perhaps they
absolute
didn't.
Absolute judgment. But it was incredible fun for 3 years. You know, you can imagine you'd have all the buyers bringing in the latest, you know, albums or videos.
Yeah.
And so I would just take them home, or sweets and confection, that sort of thing. But it gave you a relevance because you, as an accountant, finance guy, you're kind of there to work out margins and forecasting and profit and everything else. But as a person, you can relate to why Coke is selling, you know, well because it's hot, or where video games has got a great review. It's very relevant.
It's a really interesting area. We work with data analytical candidates. Mm. And one of the areas that is always fascinating to me is kind of insight analytics, where people work for a Tesco's or they work for a Boots, and they have to try and work out where should we put the store, All right, based on the demographic around that store, what should we put into it? What type of pricing should we run? And like you say, that's really relatable. To try and find headhunters who are interested in the credit risk analytics is tougher.
Yeah.
So Ray, you were with Woolworths for 3 years. Yeah, yeah. And then where did you go next?
Well, a friend of mine who had been at Woolworths, he was in charge of computer games. He was headhunted to set up a computer games company. And this was the sort of the start of the PlayStation era. And he said, I need an FD, do you want to come along? So I thought, great, to do that. And that was, I thought the job at Woolworths was pretty interesting and fun and everything. And nothing prepared me for the next 3 years. Because whilst we were a computer game startup, and this is 95, something like that, 96, we were part of a record company.
Okay.
And record companies in those days behaved in a certain way, which was new to me.
Is this when Virgin were prominent?
Yes, yeah. It was, you know, we had, the company was actually called Telstar Records. And again, in those days before Spotify, you know, you'd get your compilation album, like the best of Anton Deck and that sort of thing. And they actually had Anton Deck was one of their signings. But it was crazy, you know, crazy 3 years. You know, as finance director, we had, I mean, the office we had a little atrium in it. We had a basketball net. I'd spend all day playing computer games because we were testing it. And it was an original sort of fintech in 95, actually.
Where was that, in Soho?
No, the company was in Barnes, and we actually set up our offices in Surrey, actually, a little leafy part of Surrey.
Richmond and Barnes was rock and roll in those days,
yeah.
Right? You had the Rolling Stones.
Oh, the record company guys are on our board. One was an ex-manager of The Who. Another one had done crazy stuff. And it was, the Christmas parties were the most wild I've ever been to in my entire life. But anyway.
Not like the payment awards last night.
No, even the payment awards, it has nothing on these sort of parties. And things. But it was a completely different culture. It was the first, you know, taste of a startup. I had to remind myself I was finance director most of the time.
How old-ish were you then?
Mid-20s, you know, just it was amazing.
Ideal. Yeah, amazing. And you didn't use that as a platform to try and get your rock star career?
Well, I did, yeah. I had a few, because I was starting to get more and more into bands. And yeah, so I managed to get the guys from the company, force them to come. And so it was a parallel of, I mean, I was doing the rock and roll and they were doing the other two things, which I'm not going to say. But in the end, I kind of realized after 3 years, there was a moment when our development director, who shall remain nameless, although you probably better find it out, there was this game that had just been released. And we'd done like the fifth ever PlayStation game, something called Lone Soldier, and I was really proud of that. But this game, the new game came out, and I said to him, this might be quite interesting. I don't know much about it. Have a go and see what you think. You know, he was here, and he's the creative director of Charlie Ridley. And the next day he said, oh, that game's never going to be successful. Tomb Raider, rubbish. You know, I realized that was the end. So I went back into corporate, and I went and worked for a year with United News and Media, helping them sell their media titles, the Yorkshire Post and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then I got headhunted to The Economist. And now I look back on it, where we sold PBS to, and I'll get to that, it was really relevant because The Economist, when I joined in 1999, we were selling information in books. So basically, if you wanted a forecast of Malaysia economy, you'd buy a book and it'd be sent to you in the post and everything. And then suddenly this thing called the internet came along and there was a lot of resistance because all of our editors were second degree economists, all based in St. James's, and it was like, oh, this internet, you know, we're writing a craft, you know, we're doing this book and it's beginning and end, and you know, we're not, you know, we don't think we want to give away stuff for free and all that sort of thing. But suddenly you could see the impact it was having. And then we set up a little sort of skunk work in New York and we said, take all the content and do what you want with it for nothing, which caused a lot of friction because the guys in London, and we had office in Hong Kong, were sort of saying, well, they're just giving it away for free and we're supposed to be selling it. But what the guys in New York were doing were just starting to get their head around digital distribution, intranets, so banks stopped having libraries.
banks used to have libraries. Yeah. So if you wanted to do a bit of research, you'd go to your library, if you find the book and whatever. They started having intranets, and Bloomberg was starting to come along. So over the space of 5 years, the business was 80% paper, became 80% digital. And as finance director, my job was to sort of plan that out from a strategic point of view, but also the cost base of the company completely changed. Everything changed about the company. You know, we started, you know, we had our own printing plant, and in the end of it, we didn't. You know, we would distribute through direct mail. Then we became a digital company, corporate enterprise. So it was my first taste about what the digital could do to a company and how it changed.
How did you get money after the skunk work period when the banks realized this is absolutely how we want to accumulate our knowledge and in a timely fashion? So Bloomberg, Thomson Reuters, I understand how they would have charged. Did you have subscriptions? Did they have to pay per documentation that they would take online? Well,
we had several different models.
Right.
So we had a pay-per-view, click store. So we were one of the first online kind of e-commerce sites, you know, 1999, 2000, where you could go in and you could buy a digital copy of the report. You could even, you know, a report might have been $200, $300. You could buy a page for like $3.
Right.
It was pretty cool, actually. But it was controversial because, you know, the editors would say, well, I've done this craft. I've written this thing. You've got to read the whole thing. You know, you can't just go to the bit you want and pay $4 for it.
It's like what we have with singles now on Spotify versus albums.
It's exactly the same. Yeah, and that's why it just so resonates that you went from, a vinyl album, you had to listen to the whole thing, to, no, I just want that. And but we also then, for the banks, we started to say, okay, how are we going to plug into their internet? And the banks said, well, I want everything. And I want to access it when I want. So we went from doing, you know, selling a subscription to a country forecast for 300 quid a year, four copies, and a bank would buy 200 of those and stick them in their library, to we want unlimited access to everything in our internet. Oh, well, that's $70,000, you know, and we do it. So it was a big change in the way we sold. It was the change in the way we created the content, how we made the content, even the how we accounted for it, because you suddenly said, well, you can't cost something like that. So it became really this whole thing about digital, and actually it can change everything. Yeah. So when I left there, I was headhunted to go and work for Virgin to run their consumer publishing business, which turned out not to be the best career move, because I was only there 3 months, because Richard Branson had played tennis with someone who came in, and so it was. We went from being one MD to three MDs,
right.
And it was also. I always say it was my kind of career in smutty publishing, because Virgin Books at the time had the rock stuff, the Rolling Stones books, and they actually had Carol Vorderman, but they also had some erotic literature.
Did they?
Called Black Lace or something.
Right.
Oh, you know it.
Yeah.
No, I can tell from your look. Yeah, yeah. No.
Too young.
No, I'm just winding you up. But it was written by women for women, but somehow all the sales used to be in service stations on the M3. You know? And I'm thinking, okay, really. Anyway, that lasted 3 months, and I was fishing out something to do. I got a call. I was halfway up a tour in Dartmoor. I got a call from this French guy, who I couldn't really understand what he was saying, about, we're doing these cards and I've just started and I really like the look of your CV. And I said, well, how did you even get my CV? And it was lucky, a friend of mine was running a Love Film at the time. So what became Love Film, actually? And their investor was a company called Arts Alliance Media. And Mark, I said, look, I'm really interested in doing something in the space, or the VC space. And he gave it to one of the partners, and they were also an investor in what was then Prepay Technologies, and the CV, Philippe got my CV. He claims that he'd seen 70 finance directors, but he liked the look of my CV for some reason, and we had lunch and we started. So that was how I started. And what I liked about the time, Philippe Dufour was the original founder of Prepay Technologies, and he'd started at the internet kind of, you know, the boom, and was trying to get a product where kids could buy stuff on the internet. It's called Splash Plastic, but it didn't work. But he built some of the technology, and he was sort of thinking, what can I do with this? And he had an investor with GE Capital, and they said, well, we've got these retailers like Debenhams and Comet, and they want to do a gift card, and they don't know what it is, but they've heard about it from America. So when I joined, we just started doing that. And I liked the fact that it was technology, and I'd kind of started to get into that quite a lot, The Economist, in terms of what you do with digital. I liked the fact that it was retail-oriented, because I obviously had that experience.
Yep.
And also, there was quite a lot of regulation. And you know, I'm not going to say I liked the fact that it was regulated, but I knew as a finance guy, that was probably going to bring out some of my other skills in terms of governance and regulation and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I immediately became finance director, head of compliance, money laundering, reporting officer, everything for a company of 20 people. And then we just started the journey. And a lot of innovation is just ripping other people off. And we'd seen a company in California called Green Dot that had started to do prepaid cards like 10 years before that, primarily for migrant workers coming across from Mexico. And in the States, then and even now, banking is pretty immature, or it's poor. And so prepaid cards actually were really popular. And Philippe and I worked on how do we replicate that? So we built a new platform, and we relaunched the internet product, which was called Splash Plastic, as I said, to a Splash Plastic version on MasterCard. And it was one of the first prepaid MasterCards around about 2005, 2006 in the UK. And at that point, we were a brand. We were our own brand, and we had marketing people, and we started to do, you know, that kind of stuff. But we realized that was quite hard. So actually, we realized that, and this is a classic pivot, you know, we said, well, we're not really going to be a brand, are we? We're a service company. And that was the start of our journey to sell prepaid.
What was the moment after that where that decision came right?
When we sold the company, because we had initial fundraising from Vocalink, actually, what's now okay. Vocalink, yeah. I didn't tell too many people that, but it was 10 years ago. We were a couple of weeks away from having to go back to our original investors for more money, which would have been crippling, frankly. Anyone who's put a startup will know that. And these new investors came in. We got, at the time, a pretty nice post money of valuation of like 30 million. We got 3 million in. And as I said, without that, we would have been massively diluted. So that gave us another push. We opened another office for our technology out in Swindon in Wiltshire, because we found a lot of our engineers were getting poached by the banks because they were Java and Oracle, and the banks were starting to get up to it, and they were offering three times more money. And we had one client who was called at the time Accor Service. They were a French company who did this thing called Ticket Restaurant. But I'd never heard of Ticket Restaurant. And then someone said, well, do you remember luncheon vouchers? And I am old enough to remember luncheon vouchers. Well, that's the same thing. It's a voucher where you get your lunch and you can get tax benefits and that sort of thing, but it's all paper. And they are starting to think about whether their paper should become digital. And I thought, there we go.
Yep.
That's The Economist.
Yeah.
I know that space and I know what it means. And we started to do a pilot with these guys where we took the concept and we created a MasterCard, which only worked in restaurants. And the technology was quite innovative, because if you took that card and you tried to buy some petrol or something, it wouldn't work because we blocked it. So they liked that. They could realize, actually, we can see that will be the future. Then we got approached by a big US processor who were looking to buy us. And so we put ourselves up for sale. And after a few months, for a company with 2 million euros of revenue, we sold for 75 million euros. So we were quite happy with that. This is 2007. And then we started the journey, and we realized that we were definitely not a consumer company, we were a services company. First few years, a little bit difficult. We weren't very popular with the rest of the guys because of the valuation, we diluted their earnings, and they didn't get the bonuses, so we were pariahs. We took an investment from MasterCard 2009, and I guess the company probably plateaued for a couple of years. When you take you know, more investors, VC, becoming a JV was complex. But we really found our mojo about 6 years ago, I guess, when we had all this technology and we started to focus on global expansion and banking. And then the last, let's say, 5 years have been like that.
The market caught up with you at that point where there was a bunch of intelligent founders or SMEs that wanted the service.
Yeah, I mean, the prepaid stuff, I mean, I remember, so I don't know if you know a guy called Rich Wagner, who's a great friend of mine, and he and us, we probably launched together separate products. His product was called Cash Plus, which was the first kind of challenging product. It was a product aimed at Polish guys or who'd come into the country, couldn't get a bank account. And we kind of launched a product which was aimed at kids who couldn't get a bank account. So we were both going after markets which weren't being addressed. Actually, Richard's gone on to be really successful. So our kid product died a death. So he'd got one up on that. But that market for prepaid, open loop prepaid, was very niche. It basically was, if you really couldn't get a bank account for one reason or another, you would make do with a prepaid card because it had limited use. It was, people would quite often use it for the internet. You know, maybe people would use it on gaming websites.
It was like the companies at that time, such as Lebara, that came over for your for your SIM card only.
Yeah, it was serving a purpose, but I wouldn't say it was glamorous, and I wouldn't say it was particularly exciting. We at PPS felt that actually we'd rather work, if we could, in a different part of that market. And the first deal I signed, because I'd started to get into sales at that point, was Virgin Money. So we actually launched in 2006 a Virgin Money prepaid card. And for me, that was great because it was a good brand, good distribution. And they were a challenger. They were one of the first people who actually said, we're going to try and challenge the traditional financial services because we're Virgin. They liked the fact that the prepaid products, you could give it to anyone. You didn't have to do any credit checks. So for them, being inclusive and giving that product to everyone was really important. So that was the start of us thinking, well, maybe prepaid's got a bit more to it. It was still limited because a prepaid card in those days, you know, if you wanted to put money on it, you probably had to go to a shop, put some cash on it. You couldn't put bank money on it. You could only spend it in a shop or online or get cash out of an ATM. You couldn't get your salary loaded onto it easily. You certainly couldn't do things like set up direct debits. And there's a lot about, you know, financial, they talk the sort of poverty trap of finance, where if you can't do a direct debit with your gas bill, you've got to go to a top-up machine and pay extra, you don't get deals. So when going back to the banking story, which I touched on earlier on with George, when we started to sort of think, well, actually, if you can plug our prepaid product into the banking ecosystem, then you've got something. And that really took off. Now, why was prepaid in the right, you know, as an industry, why were guys like us in the right time in the right place? Well, prepaid historically, there's several traits about if you're going to build a prepaid platform, why is it different from a credit or debit card platform? The first thing is everything's got to be in real time. Okay. Now, in those days, it wasn't because people had apps. It was because, you know, there was no overdraft. So you had to know that the transaction you've just done, you had to take account of that in your system. Whereas debit card platforms don't do that. You know, everyone knows the experience of Monday, 7 o'clock, you might see all your transactions for the week come through your banking app, yeah, because it's all running batch. Was prepaid was always real time. So it was real time. We didn't have, you know, we didn't necessarily have a brand, so we had open APIs. So it was also about a platform. So we're connecting to other people. It was very retail and internet oriented. A lot of the prepaid products, you actually bought them online. You didn't go to a branch because there weren't any.
Yeah.
And the last thing is prepaid processing. You are looking sometimes to charge a fee on a transaction, which banks didn't do because that was the only way you could make money. So all of those sort of things were always there from prepaid at the beginning. And suddenly, as the fintech said, well, I need something that's real time because I want to plug an app into it. You know, I'm only going to sell on the internet, and you know, give me your APIs and I'll do amazing things. And those, so those things all happened. And that's how the prepaid industry drove the original Monzo, the original, you know, Revoluts, guys like Tide on the knees. That's how it happened. And that's where we are.
If we go back to in that story where you say for the first time a large event happened and a large amount of money was realised, and I assume personally also, how did that, as somebody who'd grown up in what sounds like you know, a middle class family who'd gone to university for the first time, how did that feel? Was that was an exciting experience for you? You had a good amount of money, and did that allow you to take stock and think, right, what do I actually, right, this is the job, but what do I also want to do with my life now? And how did that, and has that panned out in other interests?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have four kids, and on the back of that, all of them have gone to private school,
right,
and going on to good universities now. I have a son at Oxford, for example.
Fantastic.
So the first person in my history of my family who's ever gone to Oxford.
Amazing. And what's he studying?
He's actually doing fine art, funny enough.
Okay,
and
amazing.
He's a brilliant artist, and I keep saying to him, and he could have done other things because he had, you know, great A-levels and everything, but I said, you're brilliant, and he genuinely is brilliant. He's just got an award, actually, a scholarship at Oxford as well for his art. And I said, follow this, because you've got a chance to be amazing at this. You could be mediocre, you could be a mediocre lawyer, or you could be an amazing creative person.
Yeah.
And I also said to him, because he's thinking about career, I said, well, actually, look at all my customers. I said, look at the guys. What is the most important thing to some of these guys? It's the look, it's the feel, it's the font. I once went to a presentation of a guy called Chris Messina, who is ex-Twitter, and he came up with the idea of the hashtag. And he was going on about, now in Silicon Valley, the VCs, there's a chief design officer on the investment committee.
Wow.
And they won't invest without them saying, actually, this looks great. So I was saying to Jamie, you know, actually, being creative is what it's all about now. A robot isn't going to take your job if you're a creative guy. So yeah, so that's where the money went, actually. So unfortunately, I couldn't retire. And actually, yeah, I mean, it'd be wrong to say I didn't think about leaving once we'd exited, because that's normal. But actually, the company that bought us didn't exactly know what to do with PPS. And I think that's possibly the difference between a French company or a European company and an American company. If we'd been bought by the American processor, none of us would be here. But now, actually, Philippe Dufour is still part of the group. He has an investment fund now, and the CTO that we hired is still my CTO, actually. So we're all still around. But I was intrigued about how we could develop the company that bought us. Initially, it was, you know, what they wanted from us, and it was minimal. Okay, now we are driving that company.
Yeah.
And the company is now called Edenred, and they're on I guess 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe 4 or 5 years ago, they were on a PE of 20. They're now on a PE of, no, listed business, I think 48. We're driving their corporate digital payments. We're the largest Apple Pay issuer anywhere in the world on the back of working with Edenred. We're doing, they bought businesses in the US on the back of what we've been doing. So actually, it's a really nice story.
And your business is in, I think, Paddington?
Yeah.
Swindon. You
yeah.
just got an office in Belgium?
Yeah, that's the Brexit stuff. And we also have an office in Dubai. But yeah, we've got four offices now. And Swindon is really our operational center. And we picked Swindon, literally the CTO, my founding CTO, when we were a private company, lived in Bristol, and he used to get a train every day to London, to Marylebone. And of course, a startup, you're whiteboarding till 11, 12 at night. And he just, once we got the fundraising, he said, that's it, I'm not, yep. You know, I'm getting an office.
So he drew a map
right in the middle, boom. And it's been a good center for us. It's far enough away from London that we really talented people we can
keep.
More sticky,
frankly.
Yeah.
Hard, it's, to be fair, it's always harder to get the best talent.
Yeah.
Not that there isn't talent in Swindon, but
of course.
Inevitably...
If the business isn't trying to have some type of rapid growth in terms of people, then it's better to have less people to choose from, but where then you're sure that they're going to stick around.
Yeah.
Because the training that you put in, the intellectual property that they come to understand becomes part of the culture.
Yeah.
So I see that trend a lot. So Swindon's panned out. Well, it's not far from London.
No, well, that's why we're in Paddington. In fact, we've had several offices in Swindon. The latest one, we've got like four floors of a building that's right next to the station.
Perfect.
And so I can be in Swindon. And then I remember doing a video conference call, or I walked into a meeting in Swindon, and then we're doing a VC call to the office in London. And I stuck my head as I do, and I say, "Hi guys, how are you doing?" I got on the train. By the time I was in Paddington, the meeting was still going on. So I went into London, and then I went back to the guys in Swindon. Yeah, I'm here now. So that works really well. But the Belgian office, that's Brexit. As we grew on the back of initially guys like Eden Red, because they're in every country in Europe, and we're now in pretty much every country in Europe, but also guys like Moniz, who have a European play. So we are, with Moniz, we're in like 20 countries, you know. And we have other clients in France and the Netherlands and places like that. We realized that traditionally we were passporting. So passporting is how financial institutions can be regulated in other countries. They don't have to have a physical presence or historically. And then of course Brexit was looming, and we realized that there was too much at stake. There was uncertainty, and there's still uncertainty about passporting. So we took the decision to set up an office in Belgium and get a license from the National Bank of Belgium.
Yeah. So this has been a long period of uncertainty because of Brexit for an awful lot of companies. And for you, the way that you've dealt with it is you've got a physical presence now in Belgium for a number of reasons. One being that you're, from a banking license perspective, you have that there. You have that in mainland Europe.
Yeah.
And then is also another reason, talent.
That's a great point. I was going to come on to, I'm glad you mentioned it. We were knocked, you know, we were blown away about what was available. And my head of compliance, who spends a week every other week in Belgium, we had to hire good people to get a license approved. Because the National Bank of Belgium, they say, you've got to be independent. It's very clear that, you know, this isn't just some kind of shadow office of the UK. Because initially we thought, well, we can send a few people over, you know, every week on the Eurostar. They said, no, you've got to have people here. They've got to be qualified. We're going to vet them. And there is a fit and proper, you know, a test. So we actually literally had to send CVs to the bank. And we had some people, they said, no, that person's not experienced enough. You can't hire that person. So we had to go back. And all the time, the clock was ticking. I mean, this was, you know, before the 29th of March. So we were thinking, oh my God, you know. So the extension came just in time for us. But because it's Brussels, the people we've got, the quality is amazing. And as I said, you've got challenges when you're hiring particular skill sets in places like Swindon. I mean, I'd say legal compliance, you've got some challenges, okay? We just didn't have that. And then I sort of, it kind of made sense. Well, this is a capital city. It's the heart of regulation, the whole of Europe. So there's a huge amount of talent over there. And what we're now thinking is we've actually just hired a business development person. He's a Belgian guy. Because now we say, well, we kind of did it for Brexit, but actually we didn't just do it for Brexit. You know, this is, Europe is where all the growth is now. And we want to be in the heart. We want to be seen as, you know, a European business. So what better way to do that than to have Europeans and French speakers, Belgians, you know, Dutch speakers in an office that clients can come to.
Good to hear that we've got a positive spin out of all of this then.
Well, I, you know, listen, I'm an optimist. You can't not be an optimist. The CEO had to be an optimist, or an entrepreneur be an optimist. And I, you know, it's been expensive, and it's been a big investment for us. So I'm always looking at, well, what more can we do with this?
So being a credible, you know, say, putting sales in there and saying, well, why not sell? That is, and I was thinking about if there's any positives about Brexit, it's that UK companies who have business in Europe or even who don't have business in Europe, they're going to have to do something. Passporting is not going to exist in the same way as it does today. And it will force companies to say, if I want to really grow my business, I'm going to have to make the effort.
Yep.
You know, I can't just rely on passporting. I can't just rely on the UK. I was at the Paris FinTech Forum last week, and every company was saying, even the, you know, the UK companies said, well, UK is great, but it's if we want to be X, you know, we want to be unicorn plus, we're going to have to go outside of the UK, and we're going to have to go outside of Europe as well. So again, the positives about Brexit is it's forcing companies to think not just outside the UK, but outside of Europe as well. So the US, clearly. We're already a big issuer, a big processor in UAE, in Brazil, Mexico. We're going to be launching in North America this year.
Yeah, so you said you had an office in Dubai.
Yeah.
That's come from a client's need, or why? Yeah,
It's come from a client's need. For example, you know, they don't work on a Friday for obvious reasons. And there's a 3-hour time difference, but that doesn't really make the difference. Well, 3 or 4 hours, I don't get it right. No, it's a cultural thing as well. You know, you have to, frankly, someone who's from that community on our side, everyone speaks English, but there's a translation issue, not just the language, cultural and that kind of thing. So having that office for us was really important, yeah.
But you're not in America yet. You plan to be?
We will be processing in America. Yeah, we will be processing in America this year. One of the things I'm hoping we get out of Brexit is the equivalent of passporting in the US.
Yeah.
Because right now, in markets like Dubai and also the US, we're having to go to say, well, we want to do this stuff. We're going to have to work with another bank.
Yeah.
And that's a pain.
It's a similar business. Not in many ways, but in this way, to headhunting, particularly in fintech, where our clients are leading us to the various territories that we sprawl out of the UK to. And of course, that's Europe, places like Frankfurt and such. But New York and Silicon Valley, of course, where you now have your Revolutes and your N26s and your Monzos, really taking an aggressive approach to trying to grab that market. So assuming that's what you guys are doing too.
Well, as I said, we will be just as a processor. And again, PPS has the ability to, you know, compartmentalize what we do. So we can just do processing, not the issuing as well. But it would be, I think, if there was any positives, and it's, you know, scratching around to find positives about Brexit, if there was any positive, it would be someone in the government is doing some kind of deal with the US for equivalence or passporting or whatever it is. I'm pretty sure they're not. I remember having a dinner with a trade dinner, and Stephen Barclay was the finance minister at that time, responsible for fintechs, and he was a leaver. And I said to him, well, so, okay, we get it, but where are the deals for financial services that you're doing, you're starting to talk about, so we can go to Singapore, so we can go to Asia, so we can go to Australia, and there aren't any. So I think that's the frustrating.
So Ray, I've just got two more questions, because we've taken a lot of your time. The last one is, you've got 4 children, and we've heard about the oldest, or one of the sons?
The second oldest, yeah.
Second oldest.
Well, my eldest is at the University of Amsterdam. So you can see how Brexit and everything has an impact on my family.
Yeah, exactly. And what are they studying?
She is studying, I'm not exactly sure if I'm honest with you. No, the degree's over there. Sort of, she's doing, maybe she's doing a bit of law.
Yeah, okay.
Environmental economics, liberal science, that really.
So the question is, or the point to talk through, is you mentioned, you know, the VCs have now got somebody who's actually looking at the design element of a product. And if we hear the story that you've been through, it feels like a lot of the emerging fintechs that have been successful have been focused on the idea, and then the UX becomes important. And so we keep seeing that. And you mentioned that, you know, the human becomes unemployed on certain types of tasks, but it feels like more and more they won't if they're they're focused on the creative element.
Yeah.
So fine art's one way to do that. But if you were looking at, as you do, and let's keep this focused on the fintech space, somebody who wanted to be in that, what type of product should someone be looking at now? We've got the consumer neobanks in a race with each other. Is there another area that you predict might be the one for the next several years to look at?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious ones that people talk a lot now are, you know, regulation and insurance, pensions. You know, we've got a client that we're working with at the moment, a proof of concept who's in the pension space. That's again, and sort of an offshoot of classic fintech banking, and I sort of hadn't really appreciated that we could do those sort of things. You know, insurance is definitely up there in terms of those rigidities.
And the skill set within those that would be good ones to get right now, you truly do believe that they could be creative?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. You know,
so not computer science or data analytics?
Well, there's obviously a part of that,
yeah,
for sure. But you know, if I go back to, you know, I mentioned Errol Damlin in the day, you know, Wonga, when it started, I think it was the first fintech. I mean, it didn't end particularly well, as we all know. But the idea that in order to work out how much you wanted and how much it was going to cost you, you have a little slider that you just slid along, yeah, if you remember that. And yeah, you go this way, how much you want, you know. That is a creative thought. And that made the product amazing, you know. Behind the scenes, the fact that you could then get your money in 15 minutes to your bank account was also amazing. But that piece there. So I think in any of those models, you know, the real-time expectation, whether it's food, whether it's taxis, whether it's music, whether it's film, is expected by everyone. And therefore, the best way and the quickest way of delivering that is about the user experience.
Yeah.
You know, therefore, find that utility. And it is, you know, it's got to be creative as well. There is nothing worse than knowing that you have to do something with your app and you're dreading logging onto that app. Yeah. Okay. And I think for a long time, banks have been like that, you know, and it's still like that. You think, oh God, I've got to go and make a payment. This is going to be an absolute ball ass of bread. Yeah. And as opposed to, I love opening, you know, my Moniz app. I just love it. And everything is easy and it's great. And I enjoy it. And actually, this is neat and fun. You just want to make it an enjoyable experience. It's pretty obvious in the end. It is not a dirge. It's not, you know, a chore. And that's where the creative piece comes in. And I think there's so many parts of financial services which don't do that.
Yeah, now. It's this, like with Steve Jobs. He when he talks through his kind of university years, he took this random course in calligraphy, and that's what he attributes to, you know, then the Macintosh having different types of fonts, yeah, which of course then Microsoft stole from them, and obviously now, you know, we have this huge range of creative fonts that we can select,
yeah,
which again shows, you know, the philosophy in business and the creativity sometimes is the thing that you feel a connection with that brand,
yeah,
and you know, as somebody who's running a headhunting business, right, which is an industry has a lot of things to be creative within, you know, I spend a lot of my time painting myself outside of work, and hopefully I can.
This is like on a canvas, or are you just painting the bathroom?
Exactly. Yeah. No, on canvas, and I'm sure it's terrible. But it is originally because I did it when I was growing up quite a bit, and then left it, mm-hmm, in my 20s when I was focused on the career. When I set up a business several years ago, I just find myself before I was going to sleep, just still thinking about the business, crunching through the numbers, you know, reading biographies, just trying to be productive. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't a good idea because I never got any respite. Mm-hmm. And so I started having a glass of red wine, mm-hmm, putting some music on, mm-hmm, and painting. And it's amazing. And that's really helped to have fun, and, yeah, and also actually to switch off, which is important. Which brings me on to my final question.
Yeah.
Is how's the band going?
Yeah, the band. Well, as I said, I've been in lots of bands in my life. The most recent one, it's a band called The Love Detectives.
Why The Love Detectives?
I have no idea. I didn't come up with a name. The lead singer and the writer of most of the material is a guy I've known for 20, 30 years. And again, this is a funny thing.
Prominent in fintech?
The keyboard player, yeah, he's got an insurtech business.
Nice.
And that's one thing. Well, Nick is, he was a dad at the private school when my kids were like five. And then I think this is the great thing about music. He's Etonian, Cambridge, Morgan Grenfell. He's now doing investment funds and that sort of thing. And other than music, there's probably been very little in common, you know, and the fact that our kids were in the same school, but I wasn't from that background, okay? And so, but actually music, we're absolutely in it, and we've been working together for 20 years. And so he came to me with an idea about 3 years ago that he wanted to write an album, triggered by the death of one of his friends. And we started, you know, he sent me some acoustic version of these songs. And we spent a year really orchestrating and arranging these things and turning them into something very different. And I think on YouTube, there's a terrible clip of me saying, I regret it. They said, well, what is it about the songs? I said, well, the songs were like, they're like babies, right? You know, when they're born, they're really ugly. But when they grow up, they're really pretty. Well, my kids said to me, oh, thanks, Dad. But that's the thing. So we've been doing quite a few gigs around London, but nice venues. I mean, like Pizza Express Holborn, which people say, oh, Pizza Express? Actually, yeah, it's a jazz cool venue. It's a great venue.
It's great.
Great sound. And we put an EP.
Done the Bedford in Balham?
We've done funny thing. We've done those sort of a lot of stuff in Camden. And I remember when we played the Hope and Anchor. And when I was a kid, going back to the vinyl
cool
days,
yeah.
There's a Stranglers album called Black and White. And inside it, there was a single they gave away, which had Walk On By, one of my favorite songs. And on the B-side, it was Live from the Hope and Anchor. And I thought, wow, this must be incredible. It was like mythic that this was a place called the Hope and Anchor. We played it, it's a shit album. But we had an EP out last year called Nothing to Say. And we're working on an album too. Well, we've got all the material. We just need to get it in the studio. Of course, we're all pretty busy.
So we've got to outro this show with a select single.
Oh, wow. That would be cool. Yeah. Well, I mentioned Nick's schooling days. So there's a song on the album called Eat and Mess. And if you listen to the lyrics, they're really fun because it's the juxtaposition of where he is or was. And the pudding and the eaten and everything else, and the bass is okay as well. So let's go for eating mess.
We'll put a link to some of your upcoming gigs as well if there are.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, we love that.
Ray, thank you so much. Pleasure to have you on the show.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks,
Lindsay.
My best to swim, oh, but always bound to sink. just a needin' mess. Sounds kinda sad. I got a few friends left. Perhaps it ain't that bad. I can take the stress, 'cause I'm a needin' mess. Ooh, I'm a needin' mess. Yes, I'm a